Musician, artist, and author Lisa Gunger fell in love with music and art as a child, scribbling songs since she was just 7 years old. After college, she began recording and touring with her now husband Michael as a part of the group that eventually turned into the Grammy-nominated band Gunger. Through all of this time, her faith was the lens through which she viewed everything, her marriage, her music, and her dreams. And when that lens shattered, she wondered where her broken story would take her. The death of a friend, the unraveling of a career, the loss of a worldview, and the birth of a baby girl with heart defects all led Lisa to a tumultuous place. That is, until it gave way to a new perspective. I'm so honored that Lisa is my guest on the podcast today. Her story is a journey of what happens when you dare to shift the kaleidoscope and see new colors by way of broken pieces. Her work has touched the lives of so many people, and her story that she shares today is beyond what I would have hoped that it would be. I am Brendan Harvey, and this is Sounds Good. This is the weekly podcast where we have conversations with inspiring people who are rejecting cynicism and using their lives to make an impact. Sounds Good is not your typical Three Steps to Success podcast. We don't host this podcast for the sake of leaving you with bullet points on self-improvement. We deeply believe that our lives are more complex than that. So we show up here on Sounds Good to ask big questions, dive into nuance, and learn from each other's stories. I absolutely love this conversation with Lisa, and I hope that it sparks something hopeful inside of you. Let's jump straight into this. I really enjoyed your book. It was such an honor and such a pleasure to read, and it felt so relatable and funny. And I just wrapped it up yesterday, and I don't know, I just really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Oh man, thank you so much.
In the prologue, I want to talk about the prologue for a second, because okay. It was written to your mother, and in many ways, the book was kind of formatted in that way. I guess, tell me about your thought process behind that prologue for the book.
It kind of just came to me one day, and at first I thought this book was going to be a series of essays. It took me a while to realize this is just my story. So as I started writing out the story, and in that beginning, like I had that perspective was kind of the intro to the book. And as I got about, it was really about halfway. No, actually, that's not true. I had written the whole thing before I realized I wanted it to be a letter to my mom, because I think so many people can relate to having this difference of opinion politically, religiously with their parents or grandparents. I know very few people that are like, yeah, I can have incredibly open conversations with my parents about what I believe.
And if they do, it takes work to get to that point. It never really happens naturally, or at least I don't know anybody where it's just happened supernaturally.
Yeah, well, I think I live in a bubble in Los Angeles, because I do know some people who it's happened very naturally, but their parents were always just very open with them from a young age. And I'm not saying my parents did everything wrong, which I think is really important. What I try to paint in the beginning is this thing that most people have, the good and the bad in the same bag. You know, everyone experiences, a lot of people can experience really beautiful things and really, really tormenting, difficult things all in the same family. It's hard to really name the experience when, especially as a child, you don't know what's going on. And you know that I knew my parents loved me, and I knew that they were giving everything that they could to me. But then there was this dichotomy happening behind the scenes that nobody really saw. And it was hard to talk about as a kid, because you love your family and you just don't, it's just confusing. Childhood can be confusing. And so I think as I wrote it out, it started becoming clear. It just became clear to me, like, oh, this is the beginning of this is a letter to my mom, because these are all the things that I wish I would have explained to her as I was going through this. When I was just so silent and afraid to talk to her about a lot of these.
Yeah. What was your relationship like at a young age? What did it change over time, I guess?
Yeah. My mom was my best friend. She homeschooled me. I felt like it was that dream relationship. I mean, she taught me how to sew. She was the one that supported me in drawing and piano and, you know, like this family of sports people. I felt like she was like my one person that supported really what I loved, and vice versa. We both loved church. We both loved singing. We both would go to church anytime we could. And that's what we did together. We were best friends through and through. And so as I began changing, that was really difficult to talk about with her.
And in what ways did you kind of start changing growing up?
Well, I had questions about some things that would happen in our church. And I think it was all so fun and exciting. Like, we went to this wild church where people would like run around the church, and sometimes people would like swim on the floor because it was called River of Life. So they would pretend like that they were like swimming in this river of life.
That's amazing. Yeah. Where was this? You grew up in Texas?
I grew up in New Mexico.
New Mexico. Yeah. Okay.
So after going to these other places that, for me, like I know a lot of other people can really love the Baptist church and the Methodist church. For me as a kid, I was just bored. Oh, I hated it. I'd like count the light fixtures and draw on the hymnals. But there was this sense that I always felt like a kind of a weird, whimsical child. So when we went to this church that had flags and loud music, and the people were all real excited and dancing. And I also saw there was equality. It was really pulling on my heart. And I felt I saw people being free in their bodies and serving each other, loving the poor and giving everything they have to each other. Where I grew up was very low income area. I mean, the house I grew up in cost $50,000, and my parents sold it 12 years later for $50,000. it's not a booming city. So I think there's 9,000 people there when I was growing up. Really tiny, tiny town. Real great for meth. If you're into meth, it's a place to buy meth. Not advocating. I'm not an advocate for meth.
but if you are an advocate for meth, then it's a great spot to go. Is what you're telling people.
Yeah, I'm telling you that. First of all, don't do meth. Second of all, but if you know, oh gosh, not the rabbit trail I want to go down. And then it turned into a meth. How to get meth conversation.
Yeah, that's what our podcast is all about primarily. So thank you for bringing it back to the main focus. Anyway, so you were going to this church, experiencing this community. It was interesting. It was wild. At what point did kind of questions start to rise for you?
So it's like sometimes there would be, they'd have these moments where like everyone's laughing, like someone starts laughing and like everyone starts laughing. And it's kind of funny, like you'll hear therapists doing this actually now, like having these groups of people and they lead them through like these laughter therapies. So now it doesn't, you know, I mean, we're humans. We're all weird. All of this is weird. I think everything that we do really as humans is weird now. But at the time, you know, there were these movements that would happen, and you felt like if you weren't a part of it or buying into all of it, that you kind of weren't trusting. You didn't have faith. You weren't trusting God. So I think I was really afraid to ask, like, is this real? What is really happening? People are, you know, falling over on the ground. Is that a real thing? And if I would question it, I was told, well, you don't question the man of God. You don't question God. And so I think I had these two things, parallel things happening. I had a lot of freedom happening in my life. Because again, like the church was run by a man and a woman. And I didn't realize that wasn't happening everywhere in the world. You know, as a child, I'm thinking that men and women are equal. And so I was given a voice as a young girl and taught to play the piano. I led music there. So I was given these opportunities that many girls aren't given. And I was told that I mattered. I was told what my feelings matter, my emotions matter. I think that that's really rare.
Yeah, that's a big deal. That's a really big
deal. Yeah, huge deal. And I don't discount that. So, but then also, I think after I went to college, it wasn't until I went to college that I really realized, and this happens so many places, people are on your side if you're on their side. Hmm. So the moment I started going to a different church, which Michael and I laugh at all the time now, but that's a real thing in the church world. You go to a different place that they don't agree with and you can get disowned. So yeah, we laugh because if you go to two churches, that's seen as a bad thing. But I thought I was like a super Christian for going to two different churches.
And you're in college, and is this the church that this is Michael, your then boyfriend, takes you to? Is that kind of what's happening?
I was leading the music at one, helping lead music at one place, one church. And then a friend of mine took me to, people would call it Gungers. So it was called Believer's Church. But at the time they'd say, hey, do you want to go to Gungers Church? Because that's our last name. So we started going, and it was on Friday nights, and it was the big thing in Tulsa. Tulsa, Oklahoma was where we were going to school. And there was this crazy looking guy on stage that would play the guitar and had all this like wild, crazy hair. And I just thought like, wow, what a weird looking guy. And it ends up that I like end up dating him.
Oh, God.
So that's
it.
Michael. And he's the worship leader there. So, and that took a while. I mean, he chased me for a while, and I wasn't interested. I didn't want to date a worship leader. I didn't want to date a pastor's son. in that circle, he became like really popular. He was this really popular guy, and all the girls really liked him because he sang songs to God and they thought that was so sexy, you know? the things that are sexy when you're like super Christian is really funny.
So funny. And were you at a Christian college too, or was it a just mm-hmm. normal? Okay, cool.
Yeah, yeah. Like girls, us girls, we had a curfew, and the boys didn't.
What? That's terrible.
Yeah, I think you know they thought as the girls are all in their dorm rooms, the boys aren't going to have sex, and I don't know. I think they just didn't think any homosexuals were or bisexuals or were going to their school.
Oh my
like,
gosh.
Like, what about? So it was just all super bizarre. But again, like you, if you, you're in this thing, you just can't see how strange some of the rules are. You just can't. I mean, it's weird to me that this is my story. Even some, all of our friends now, they consider me like a mole woman. Just came out of this super crazy place. But again, there were these things that happened at a young age that I feel really opened up my heart and were, I feel lucky for many of the things that happened. But then also there was all this control and manipulation that I just couldn't see. So I'm in college and I'm beginning to realize it. And I get in trouble for going to different church. And
is it like a theology issue or is it just straight up control?
No, it's just straight up control. It's same.
Got it.
I mean, I guess they would probably say it's a theology issue, but I think people were, the pastor who was Michael's dad was telling college students like that they have a voice and that they, and specifically when all this stuff was going on with me, they were basically saying, you know, well, Lisa, she's in college. She should be able to decide what her curfew is or what church she goes to. Like she's in essence a grown woman and I have a job. I'm paying my bills. I'm paying for school, you know? So they were so confused by this control.
And I think that's probably such a relatable thing for so many people, even outside of the faith world, because most social justice issues are issues of control and freedom and people realizing that they have freedom and that they're born for freedom and trying to take that. And then other people's like, you know, trying to control that because control is so much easier. Like it feels so much more black and white and simple, but obviously that is not the healthy approach to this, but it's almost understandable and relatable in that way.
Yeah. And it's wild looking back. I mean, I still see there's many circles that do that now still. in the Christian world. They think that they've been given this like authority from God to control other people, and they truly feel like it's healthy. Like they really believe that. They don't believe they're being bad people. They believe that God has given them this mandate to keep people on this quote unquote like straight and narrow, and that they're the ones that know what that straight and narrow is for people. So when you fall out of line or you start making your own decisions, you are pushed out. So that was, I think, my first experience being pushed out. Yeah, I received a letter from the church, and they told me I wasn't following God's will for my life anymore. And it was so bizarre to me because I felt like I truly not just doing all the things. I know that I wouldn't say like, oh, I'm praying 5 prayers a day. And I didn't have like this laundry list of things that I did to make me feel like a good Christian. But in the center of my heart, I felt within and around like that God was with me and I was with God. So it was really, that was such a confusing time in my life. And I feel like I stopped listening to myself and trusting other people's opinions so much for what direction I should take for my own life. It was confusing because I felt like I was in the wrong. Even when they sent me that letter, I was so hurt and I didn't tell anyone about it. I didn't even tell Michael. And we were probably about 4 months away from engagement at that time. So I didn't tell my closest friends.
Was it shame or what do you think that was?
No, yeah, it was shame that because I thought maybe I thought I was wrong because I shouldn't be going to do churches. I shouldn't be dating this guy. There's really something wrong. I must be a rebellious kid because I want to make my own decisions. So I had a lot of crushing shame. I mean, I was sick a lot. And I remember going to the nurse all the time, so stressed out. And there were so many things happening around that time. That was the first year my parents were divorced, feeling all this tension within the church. And then really soon after that, and I don't even talk about this in the book, but after Michael and I were engaged, it came out that Michael's dad had an affair and everything fell apart. So even in that, it was this sense that, oh, they were right, you know.
Hard. Yeah, it like justified them.
Yes, yes. And I think it's hard when people go through things like that. He was made out to just be this, Michael's dad was made out to be this just terrible person. And you go, God, like, he's wonderful. He's a wonderful father and husband. And
yeah, it doesn't diminish all the positive experiences that you had with him or that his community had with him.
Yeah. So it really, things like that really demonize people. And that's what you remember for, right?
Yeah.
So it was all like such a hard season. And Michael and I, we get married and we just get out of there. Like we moved to Michigan, start working for a big church. And, but then, yeah, as it happens, like the questions still like kept growing and growing and growing.
And is that weird working at a church and having those questions just continuing to bubble?
Yeah. Yes. Yep. I mean, we had a lot of beautiful, positive experiences as well. I mean, we were both college kids and they paid for Michael's school. I finished my degree. We had a car that was paid for. We were both 20 years old. I mean, we were children and working at this church of 10,000 people. So it was really bizarre. I mean, it was bizarre all we were given. We built a house out in the country. Life was easy because we had a great job, great friends, great community. But yeah, it was this thing that's underneath all of it. You're going, is this all really what it's, is this all true, what we've been given and what we've believed and what we are, not just what we've been given, but what we're giving other people and what we're telling other people, all of this is what the earth is and God. And like, we had all the answers. Right. And yeah, that slowly unraveled and then quickly crashed.
Isn't that weird how, when you're kind of put in like an authority figure place and you realize, you know what, I don't have all the answers and I'm like running the show, mm-hmm. all these other people who are running the show, maybe they don't have the answers either.
Yeah, and that's scary because you want to believe that you want to have certainty, you know, that's feels pretty helpful in life. When you don't have certainty, you, some people love it. I think there's different personalities, you know, can thrive in the questions or when some, like I have a cousin, he was just elated when some of these things fell apart for him. Hmm. And he felt so much freedom immediately. But I think for us, it was so difficult because our entire lives were built around church and around this very specific construct of God, specifically like the evangelical construct of God.
And you guys become pretty popular figures in this world of things. You guys start a popular band that's really beloved by the evangelical Christian community. You can probably still hear some of your songs. I don't know if you can still hear some of your songs on the radio today.
I don't know. I don't know if they play us anymore. I think we were blacklisted.
I'm sure that it's on the radio still because it's good. But if they know the backstory, they're probably not super into it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, one of the main Christian radio stations, the guy got really, really upset at us.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It started calling all of our shows and telling promoters, like, don't go. If you support these people, we'll never support you again. So it was a war. It was really strange. So I don't think
we're probably getting a little ahead of ourselves. Maybe we should back up a little bit to explain why. Anyway, yeah. So you're asking yourself all these questions and you're kind of living within this world of things. What kind of happens next?
Well, I think we just keep running into people. And the more that your heart is open to people, the more you change. And I think it's also we started traveling because it's easy to remain in a bubble when you don't go anywhere else and you're in an echo chamber and everyone's just agreeing on all the same things. So we started traveling with our band. We started getting invited to play music other places. And then we started traveling overseas. And I remember the first really big shift, or one of there's many, but like one of the first was going to Auschwitz. We went to Auschwitz around the time we were trying to have kids. We ended up trying for about 6 years to have a baby. And the doctors told us, well, we don't know, you might be having miscarriages. We don't know what's going on. And I was doing all the, you know, the shots, the just all the fertility stuff that can really make you crazy. And we ended up going to Auschwitz. We traveled through Europe for a month by train. That opened our eyes a bit more. Because I mean, walking the ground that they walked, and you go into the, we went into the crematoriums and we saw children's shoes and hair and suitcases. And I remember just having a big piece of my faith break, because I always thought faith was a transaction and God was this transactional thing, this guy in the sky that would give good people things, right? And when you eventually get to the end of that idea, if you really think about your belief, you will run to the end of that. It will break apart at some point. That's not how life works. And so I remember thinking, God, I'm sure that they prayed to be saved. There's so many parents walked out of there and lost their children. How can I pray for a baby? And how can other people tell me, just pray and believe that this will happen? I couldn't anymore. So that's when I stopped praying and stopped reading the Bible, because I just couldn't. It was too painful. I just kept seeing the concentration camp and thinking about all the families there. And so I didn't know where to go in my faith, because it was too painful to even approach it. And so in that time period, we'd moved to Denver and we'd started a church, and that was wonderful. Like it was like this really ragtag group of people, that was so like raw and really disorganized, which is not the great thing, but just I feel like that's such a cliche thing when people talk about, we're just really living our lives together, you know, but we were sharing our life and we were sharing our doubts. And it was the first place that we could really be ourselves and talk with other people about what we really believed and them as well. So it started as a tiny church or a little house church in our apartment. And then it just kind of grew. It just grew.
Do you think it grew because people were craving that sense of genuineness it started in your house, you know, mm-hmm. so it's got to feel personal. Do you think that's what people were craving?
Yeah, I think everyone just wanted to finally talk about all the things that they hadn't been able to talk about.
And are you guys talking about things like doubts and questions, or is that still below the surface?
No, we're talking about all of that.
Okay.
Talking about doubts and questions, we're totally like unraveling the theology that we'd all been given. And honestly, what we had come from was a lot of sexism, a lot of inequality. I mean, we came from one of the places that we had worked at. I mean, I remember they all were laughing at homosexuals. And like, there was a joke, like if you, you know, would get like, you're going to get catch the gay. It's awful. I mean, it makes me sick to my stomach thinking about some of the things that happened at some of these places that we've been. So they're completely homophobic. And so we are living in a gay neighborhood, and all that whole idea is gone for us, that there's any separation between who God loves and who God doesn't, and who is in and who is out. That whole thing dissipates for us. So that's when more of the public tension starts happening for us, because within the church world, you're really not supposed to accept, or then you weren't supposed to accept the homosexual lifestyle, which speaks not to just that, it speaks to equality even.
Yeah. I mean,
because women, I was just reading this book by, oh man, where is this book? It's called Bad Feminist.
Oh yeah.
Have you heard of that book?
I've heard of it. I haven't read it.
Oh, it's so good. But she speaks to that, how gay rights didn't just fight equality for like same sex marriage. It fought for the equality of women, because even, especially within the church at that point, women were the second. We are the ones who created sin, we brought on the fall, and we belong to our husbands. And so there'd be, you know, all these caveats, of course, like, well, you know, you submit to one another in love. But I don't know how many times I heard, oh, but the man is the leader of the household. Mm. And if there's an argument, you go with the man's decision. So, there's so many things that were being challenged as we were in Denver, and so many ways that we're changing. It's like, I mean, I feel like we're completely different people now than who we were even then in when we were in Denver. So we're questioning all these things. A lot of it's being torn apart. We're receiving a little bit of attention because we have a big song on the radio, but then people start realizing that we, all the things that we are for. And then it comes to the point for us where Michael is having such a battle with everything. We're always really open with each other, which I'm so glad for. We never hid anything from each other. So for him, this was a very normal conversation. And he would say he didn't realize how much this threw me. But we're just walking along one night and strolling. We fight. We end up having a baby girl, which changes me even more drastically. So I'm like, oh, I don't understand how a good God would burn people forever, you know, in this lake of fire, or that there's any kind of separation. Because it doesn't matter what my daughter would do. This intense parent love just changed me. So we're strolling her along again, just having a conversation about what we believe in. And Michael says, and so I don't believe in God anymore.
That's a big moment.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, I remember thinking, I mean, all of that, even leading up to it, like, oh, my mom was right. They were all right, you know. He is leading me astray. He's an atheist. We're supposed to question what we believe, not become atheists. It was like atheism was like that's the door you don't go through.
Yeah. Ever. It's like you were asking all these questions about God and about these things. And then all of a sudden, like, there is no God to ask questions about in his mind.
And it was interesting because I saw the struggle that he went through. I knew why he came to that conclusion, but it was always the scary thing that I couldn't let myself question or even say, even though I had days where I wondered that. I'm like, God, where are you? I'm so tortured believer, right? And we feel like we're many days we're like split-brained, believe one day and then are writing it all off the next day. And if you don't go through that, it's a strange thing to hear someone go through. You know, if you don't struggle with doubt or if you've never believed anything at all, but when you grow up with a certain belief system and you have it all crumble, it's incredibly painful. It was really hard walking through all of that. And I didn't know, and Michael and I had been married 10 years by this time. I didn't know if we were going to stay married, what would happen to our daughter. I mean, all of these questions came into my mind and I was just so afraid.
And those are all happening internally on that walk or over the course of weeks or?
Yeah, both. Yeah. I think, both. on the walk, like when he said that, I had this great like revelation about love and not just love, but yeah, gender roles, what I expect of a husband, what we all expect of humans and what we talk about vulnerability and like vulnerability can be such a buzzword, but do we really want that? Like when shit hits the fan, do we really want people to really tell us how they're feeling? And like, I wanted a guy who could question things and come to better answers and be this, I mean, yeah, honestly, it was at the time really embarrassing to admit, but I wanted like this superstar Christian guy. We were living our dream and we were traveling the world at this time. And we loved traveling. We loved traveling with our daughter. We loved all the people in our band. And it really was a gift to be able to do that and sing all over the world and play music and get paid to play music for a living. It was wonderful. And so I didn't want that starts to feel really great, right? When everyone just really loves you and they think highly of you and you're this leader, that feels really good. And that's a real ego game.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me a little bit of what you were saying about earlier when you were in college about, you know, you were starting to listen to other people's opinions and less so kind of looking inward at how you were feeling about things. And now it was the opposite where people were kind of praising and appreciating and respecting what you guys were doing publicly. But I guess, you know, internally and personally, there was a lot that people weren't seeing yet.
Yeah. It's like we felt this opening of our hearts and this opening of our belief system. And then it just crashed. And it didn't go public right away, even though we were very open about it. And Michael ended up talking about it at the church we started in Denver. Everyone there was very wonderful. And like,
oh, that's cool.
Yeah, that it was really shocking, a shock to us how many people were just like, oh yeah, I've had the same questions. I'm so glad that you feel the freedom here to share these questions. We'll see you next week. Yeah, I think we were like ready for this war, this outrage, and we were really embraced by most of the people. I think some of the leadership did not like it.
Of course.
And that ended up being the thing that changed everything. We left Denver, or we started making plans to leave Denver, and then I'm actually pregnant at the time.
With your second kid.
Yeah, with my second kid. And then we find out soon after, like a few minutes after she's born, that she has some heart issues and she has Down syndrome.
What is that moment like?
That was devastating. On this side of it, it's hard to talk about those first moments with her because, I mean, she's amazing. I feel so lucky. I mean, I'm not just saying that. I think everyone should have, her name's Lucy. I think everyone's life would be so good if they had a Lucy. She's like,
that's so sweet.
She's so amazing. I'm tearing up. She's like, oh God, this kid, she's so wonderful. Oh, she's so funny and just a blast to be around because she has taught us like how to be present, right? Like, you know, there's like a million books out that's like how to be here now. All the gurus of the world, like that's what they're trying to teach us. And we got that in our house here. This kid she's four right now and she doesn't have this understanding of like future. Like, are we going to go do blah, blah, blah? You know, she gets super pissed if I'm like, don't tell Lucy what we're going to do later because she's going to get so pissed if we don't do it right now.
That's funny.
So it's like her ability is she's in the now all the time, which is
awesome.
That's
so beautiful. I need that.
So if you're not, like if you're constantly planning the future, then you're going to piss her off and it's going to be an awful day. But if you're just here now, then she's great.
And what was your understanding of Down syndrome kind of before she was born? Because, you know, that has everything to do with how you immediately respond is kind of the context and the paradigm for other experiences you've had.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding of it was very limited and very naive. I was very uneducated about what it was. One of my best friends has a brother who has Down syndrome and autism. And I mean, I'll be honest, it's really hard. I've been around him about three times because he lives in a different state and he's wonderful. He's such a wonderful kid, but it's also really difficult. He is nonverbal, so he can get really frustrated because he's trying to communicate and he can't. And he's learning that now. Like, I think he's been in programs now that are really helping him be able to communicate. But from what I've heard from other mothers is some of the things when Down syndrome and autism mix, that can be really difficult. Still really, really beautiful things about it as well. Every parent I've spoken with, they've had their own lesson in the learning the value of a human life in that. So that's not to discount their life and how beautiful and valuable their humanity is, but it's hard. And also the other child that I knew with Down syndrome, she passed away when she was 1 year old. So that's all I knew. I never exposed myself to disabled people or mentally ill people like I wish I had. And then I think if I had, I wouldn't have been so scared. I know I wouldn't have been so scared. So we're afraid of what we don't know. So all I'm seeing is like, Lucy's life is going to be hard. She's going to die. From the moment they put her in my arm, she started turning blue. And they took her for some tests. And it's all really blurry, like that whole time frame in there in the hospital, because like my body just went into like trauma mode. And I'm like, I felt myself like floating above my hospital bed, just kind of watching everything happen. So I couldn't give you like, and then this happened and then this happened. Like it's all really fuzzy. But what I do remember is they brought her back to me and she was going to try to nurse, which is really difficult for kids with Down syndrome because they have low muscle tone. And so it's hard for babies nursing's hard anyways. So put low muscle tone with that. And I was just like, I don't think she's going to be able to nurse. And I had all this immediate fear I had this thing come up in me. I didn't want her to nurse because I thought she was going to die. And I thought, if I nurse her, I'm going to love her more. Cause we loved her immediately. And then we were completely terrified. And I just thought I didn't think she was going to make it. And if she did, I thought we would have her for like very little time. But then she started nursing, and it was this, that's in the book where I talk about like this thing that happens, like our intelligent bodies or this spirit, whatever soul, whatever you want to call it, like whatever programming that we receive, there's these things that can happen in your life and this like seeing that can come through that is so beautiful that to me, like my experience was it transcended everything I was taught and programmed to think and believe. So that was when like I felt whatever other sight my body has, like it saw her and saw that. That was this total flip of really reality. That's been a whole journey. So we had this journey of faith and shifting in our faith, and then this baby girl that really flipped everything for us to see how everything, all of life, has this beauty and this connection, and that it's not about what we produce and what we give, and it's not about this measurement system that we've all made up, you know. And you sense that, just that intrinsic beauty of not only humanity but all of life. Man, I mean, it has drastically changed us. It's been amazing. Yeah. So she's four now.
She's four now. That's yeah. Incredible. And so what have the last 4 years looked like as you've been learning and getting to know her and, you know, interacting, I guess, experiencing her interacting with the world and then also the world interacting with her? What's been that growing process?
It's been some of the best and most painful times. Mm. More so the best, because she's just so fun and awesome. And I think she's like, it's just changed us so much. So right after, I will say real quick, I forgot to mention this. So right after she was born, she had her first surgery. And then we had this whole thing. We were not sure if we should move, stay at the church in Denver or move. We didn't know what was best because at the time, Michael's an atheist. So the other pastor's like, how do I lead a church with an atheist? You know? And so it was this big wrestle. We ended up leaving because we didn't want the whole thing to fall apart. We didn't know. We could have been all wrong in all of our decisions that we made, but we were like drowning, right? Because Lucy had her first surgery. She's going to have her second surgery at 6 months. It felt like we were just trying to survive. So we end up without a place to live for a short period of time. So we go to this lake house, and that's when we received the information that like it blew up publicly. Not that Michael's an atheist, but that he didn't read the Bible in the literal sense. So that blew up, and that's when everything started crashing career-wise.
And I think I remember that as just a listener of the band and as a follower on social media.
Oh, okay.
And it's a harsh, like the Christian media world is, it can be harsh and nasty, and I can't imagine how difficult it is to just sit there and not really be able to respond, because, you know, in addition to, you know, there being so much more to the story, and you don't have the ability to actually change people's minds, you also are juggling so many other things in your life. You know, you're dealing with surgeries and kind of juggling two kids. Like, there's a lot going on for you.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of times I was like, well, now we're going crazy. I mean, this is the end for us. We would just lay on the floor and stare at the ceiling and just think, what is happening in our lives? And I mean, I called my mom, I called a therapist a couple of times and said, I think I'm mentally ill. I think I'm falling over the edge of insanity. Like I my body, like I couldn't take the pressure.
And in hindsight, do you think that's true?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. You were just at this breaking point.
Yeah. I think I couldn't, I was so full of fear and fear of like what everyone, all this pressure from the outside of what everyone was saying to us. And then also financially, like our finances were crashing and our shows were getting canceled left and right. We had 2 major surgeries to pay for our daughter. And then internally I'm going, what are we doing? The trajectory of my life, this was not how it's supposed to go. I've been faithful, and God, we've been true. Like, we've been doing the best we can. And yes, I'm sure we've done a lot of things along the way that were not the right things, whatever that means, you know, but that sense of being tricked and that sense of, at the end of it all, like the one thing that still remained true was like, God, I thought that you would hold us, even if everything crumbled, that I would still keep my sense of calm and centeredness of who I am. And now I feel like I'm like actually losing my mind. How can this happen? And I remember even speaking to another person. I was like, I need help. I think I need help. I have so much anxiety. I can hardly sleep. Every morning I wake up and I'm terrified. I'm stressed out. I think Lucy's going to die every single night. And it's just that every morning I would just walk into her room fearful that she was going to be dead, that her heart would go out and that she wouldn't make it to her next surgery. Like, I was not prepared for the amount of stress that my body would feel. And so then there were times that I would, a lot of practices that I began that I would try to help that, you know, just to process, and being with friends or meditation. And there was all this fear even behind all some of these practices that I was doing. And then I would try to pray. And then that was like a spiraling thing, you know? So I remember someone laughed at me and they were like, ha ha ha, like, God's not going to let you go crazy. God doesn't let people go crazy. And I was like, what the fuck? people lose their minds. It happens all the time. What are you living in, some kind of alternate reality? It felt like we were living in bizarre. I felt like I was living in bizarre world and had very little outlet to be fully myself and really we felt very alone. I mean, Michael and I would talk to each other about our fears. There were very few people I felt like we could talk about, because I thought we were just getting ousted and pushed out of this like spiritual faith community. So not even just the church, but like people that believe anything, you know, believe that there's more than this reality here that we see. So it was really like step by step by step. You know, people will ask us like, well, what was that like being depressed and going through this crazy time? What was like the one turning point? And it was really just, all right, we're doing this again this next day. And this next day I'm choosing to get up again, and I'm feeding my kids, and I'm putting one foot in front of the other, and I'm not looking at social media, and I'm not looking at what everyone else is saying about us. And it was such a gradual process. And we'd moved to Los Angeles, and I felt like that gave us a nice distance, and we kind of became a little bit of hermits for a while. We were writing a ton of music to process. So music was how I processed my grief and my anxiety and my stress. And we wrote a trilogy of music during that time. It was 3 different CDs, and it's like walks through that whole process of like death and rebirth, which is completely what we experienced. And being on the other side of that now is it's wild.
That's incredible.
I mean, even as I like, as I relay the story, I'm like, oh my God, that sounds like pretty dramatic. But it was very dramatic and painful and wonderfully heart opening and beautiful. And is now, I'm grateful that we went through all of that.
And what a beautiful thing to also choose to let people into that, you know, whether it's through your music or through, you know, conversations like this or through your book. I don't know. I think it's really incredible that you went through that in that, you know, you're in many ways, you know, there's still a process that I'm sure you'll be going through for a long time, but it's, I think it's such a cool thing that you've chosen to let people into that experience, and that it's no doubt helping people.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting. I think, I mean, many different people will talk about this, that there's this, like, this building up of your life, and what, in your, you reach your dreams, you're trying to, like, reach this success, this thing that you think life is. And there's, and you're really building yourself up for the fall. I think Richard Rohr talks about that. So this whole idea of the fall is something that we create within ourselves, and we built this avatar of who we're supposed to be, and that eventually crumbles, and then we see who we really are and what all of this really is. And that's a painful but such a beautiful experience.
Mm.
And such a necessary journey. I mean, if you're really, if you're really digging,
yeah,
if you're really digging to beneath the surface, like, there's, I think there's going to be that crumble.
In many ways, I feel like most of the people that I admire most, most of my favorite people, the people that I learn from and relate to, are people who have experienced that fall.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's like you don't want anybody to have to experience it, but also when you do, I don't know if the right word is beautiful. You know, it's, mm-hmm. it's important. I don't know, but it's, it's not the worst thing. I don't know, but it also is. I don't know how to put words to it, but it's remarkable.
It is, yeah. I think, I mean, when you said beautiful, I think that is a great word for it, because you think that these things that are only going to be painful, you think it's just going to ruin you and be painful, but then it's not only that. It's, and that's a weird, wild thing to experience beauty right within something really painful, which is what we felt with Lucy. It was so painful because we didn't want her life to be hard, but then it was so beautiful because we were so blind to what she was, and we're experiencing what she is. So that, like, how profoundly beautiful that was. And then in faith, I mean, when all that falls apart, you think the loss of that is only going to be painful, but then it opens the space for this truer thing to be born.
Mm, that's beautiful. And you feel like you're in that place right now?
Yeah, I think, you know, when we were with some friends last night, and we were all laughing because a lot of us have come from that early circle that I talked about, you know, big fundamental evangelical, yeah, you know, ideology. So we were laughing at ourselves. Like, we would think that ourselves now were so backslidden, and they were like, well, maybe we are, you know. And we're all just laughing at how life is now, but how beautiful and wonderful it is, and how we're those people now. Like, we used to think that all the LA people were just the weirdo, crazy people doing their sound baths, and, you know, going out to Ojai and doing their spiritual weirdo experiences. And then we're like, oh, that's us. We're totally doing that. We have followed that path all the way here. It feels like I'm, like, on a third life. Like, I see my child self, and then all the framework around who that girl was, and then the girl who, this successful thing that was, like, living all her dreams, like, that was, like, this second version of myself. And now this, like, I feel like I'm in this space where that now space, which, yeah, again, Lucy and my other daughter, Amelie, has taught me so much about, and letting go of what people think, letting go of a need to build up any kind of false self again.
Yeah.
And what a place of calm that is.
Yeah. And maybe this is a nice time to just kind of transition out of the episode with one last question, which is kind of along these same lines. You know, the subtitle of your book is Opening Your Eyes to Wonder. And, you know, for people who are listening to this and they, you know, they want to experience what you've experienced in this kind of beauty that's come from things, and maybe more so a sense of wonder. How can we all open our eyes to wonder?
I think it's pausing and listening a lot. Because if there, that is one thing I've learned is I can't tell you how to do that. Like, I can't say like, well, this is what worked for me. You should go out and adopt a baby with Down syndrome. I mean, that would be awesome. You should do that. But like, that will teach you a lot. But like, for the each individual, it really is that thing. Like, I cannot tell you the thing that you need to hear. You need like that. Yes, there's books. There's a lot of wisdom out there. You could spend your whole life reading every book that's out there, just trying, right? Like, just trying to attain. And it's letting go of the trying, letting go of that tension of trying to be something, trying to fix something within yourself, trying to fill in that blank. If I just had fill in the blank, then I would accept myself. And then someday I'm going to be the best version of myself. Like, oh, that's just letting go of that and listening. I try to go into the mountains a lot, or just be around trees, be around nature. That helps me. And I'm just silent and I just listen. But if you're silent long enough, I think you find the answers you're looking for, or the acceptance that you're looking for. I think that's a good place to start.
Lisa is such a force to be reckoned with. This conversation was truly a gift because it holds a story about perspective, the dot where we all start, the line where we journey on, and the circle we come home to at last. And I'm so thankful for how Lisa is using her voice for good in the midst of so much heartbreak. For those of you walking through your own story of doubt and brokenness, I hope that Lisa's words spark the beginning of something deeper for you, and that you would know that the hardest experiences often end up saving us. If you aren't already following Lisa on social media, you absolutely should. You can find her on Instagram and Twitter with the handle Lisa Gunger. And of course, during this episode, we talked about Lisa's new book. It's called The Most Beautiful Thing I've Seen, and it is so good. Oh my goodness, I loved it so much. I was challenged by every page and so deeply inspired. The book is available wherever you buy books. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local bookstore. Go pick it up. It's fantastic. If you're new to Sounds Good, we would love for you to stick around. You'd also love our episodes with incredible and creative mothers, Elsie Larson and Nirmi Firebrace, two women who I deeply admire. You can find both of these episodes and more than 100 other episodes by searching for Sounds Good wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like what you're hearing, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts so that we can reach more people with these powerful stories. It also helps us attract more guests that are amazing and talented and inspiring. Thank you so much for your help. This podcast was created by me, Brandon Harvey, as a part of Good, 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 a community that believes in the power of celebrating good news and becoming good news. Chad Michael Snavely and the team at CM Studio edit and mix the show, and Chrissy Karenbrock offers production support. You can get lots of hopeful stories on social media by following us everywhere at GoodGoodGoodCO. And issue 5 of our Good News paper is just around the corner. Mark your calendars for the end of August. We are so excited to bring this to life. Our team has been working so hard, and we can't wait to show you what's inside. We've got stories to tell, and we don't want you to miss out. So make sure you go subscribe to the Good News paper at our online store at shop.goodgoodgood.co, or follow the link in our show notes or on our Instagram or wherever else you interact with us on the internet. And on that note, that is a wrap for this week's episode. Go out and remember that one of the most important things we can ever do is open our eyes to wonder and pay attention to the beauty all around us. Sound good?